You know, when I was reporting years ago in Colombia, I heard the same thing almost every time I got out of a taxi cab. The taxi driver would say as I left, suerte, luck, a single word. Not good luck, not bad luck, just luck. As I've thought about it over the years, I realized that was appropriate because when you have luck, when something happens in your life by chance, you often don't know if it was good luck or bad. Tina Brown, the editor of the Daily Beast and Newsweek, is going to talk us through that theme with some of her recommended readings. It's a regular feature here called Word of Mouth. She gives us suggestions on what to read, and Tina Brown is on the line once again. Hi, Tina.
Good morning, Steve.
And you start with an article from GQ. The headline is The Luckiest Village in the World.
Yeah, this is a fabulous piece of very offbeat reporting by Michael Paterniti. It's about a village in Spain, in Aragon, called Sodita. Very poor farming village. And this town decides to enter the annual Christmas lottery in Spain, which is known as El Gordo, which is actually Spanish for the fat one, which is this massive lottery, which is worth 720 million euros. And the whole country participates in this kind of annual ritual of everybody hoping to win. And by some incredible, you know, piece of fortuitous luck, this little village wins. And he describes, first of all, the ecstasies of the win, and then what really happens later. He starts by saying, luck is childhood again in the garden, naked and innocent. How could this be? That is the feeling when they all win. He says the first stage of luck is being chosen, and the massive rush of ecstasy and disbelief at being chosen before everything that will come next, before they realize the full impact of their winnings. Luck is a humble village bound by mud and straw, touched by this bolt of light. But then he goes on to do what I absolutely love when any reporter does. He actually goes on to discuss what happens later, because this first wonderful rush where everybody feels kind of morally blessed almost by this Michelangelo hand that has stretched down and saved their lives, it all begins to change. And because at the end of it, after a time, what actually is shown is that while luck is democratic and touches everybody equally, money is secretive. Money is selfish.
And now they're supposed to share all this money.
Now they're supposed to share all this money. And he says, you know, how the neighbors soon grow apart. They're no longer unified by common fortune. And he writes that a strange reversal afflicts the citizens of Sodito. They claim to possess fewer and fewer winning tickets than they first announced. You know, they start to hoard and not say what they've got. The people who said when they won that they were going to help this person, gradually those things are forgotten as they think about, well, no, maybe I'll keep it for myself and buy myself a new flat screen TV. And also money is suspicious, you know, that people who have money start feeling that other people want it. And so what actually is shown is that the luckiest person, in a sense, at the end of this story is the loser who was the only person in the village who didn't buy a ticket. Because this guy who didn't win, who everybody felt very sorry for, at the end of the story, he has decided to make a little movie with a Danish film crew about what actually happened to his village. And because he's done something, you know, himself, because he's actually tried to do something, he feels actually happier and more at peace than really anybody in the village. He says, the writer, luck is a facade and fatigue. Luck is not having to worry, but also working hard to preserve the things that once gave your life meaning, like work and love. So the wonderful morality, really, story is that luck isn't so lucky in the end. It's much, much better for the soul, in a sense, to work for your own rewards.
Now, you mentioned that a documentary film crew showed up to document that. We're also going to talk about a movie along the way of this next story in the New York Times. The Boy Toys story is the headline.
Yes, I just adored this story by David Siegel about Liberace's young lover, Scott Thorson, 40 years younger than Liberace when the great showman met him, picked him up when he was only 17 years old. He was an abused child of parents who treated him incredibly badly from a rotten background. And Liberace fell absolutely madly in love with him and moved him into his house. So much in love with him was he that he actually insisted even that he drove him on stage in his limousine and opened the door for Liberace when he got out, just so that he could see him on stage when he was there at all times. And of course, this was lightning striking that this great showman could pick him out and shower him with jewels and shower him with furs and shower him with gifts. But of course, like as one can imagine, these things go wrong. First of all, there's something very deeply creepy, of course, about this love affair. Liberace even got him to have a chin implant and a facial reconstruction so that he could resemble himself.
Liberace wanted a lover, but also wanted a son in the same person here.
Exactly,
basically.
Right. He wanted those two things together, perhaps the ultimate act of narcissism, to really want to be in love with yourself. And after a time, in order to lose weight, also to please Liberace, he gets addicted to amphetamines and becomes, in fact, a drug addict, and, of course, is kicked out in the end by Liberace after 5 years and sues him for palimony, which he loses and ends up with less, I think, than $100,000. And so then the spotlight again leaves him. And like with the other story, what I find completely fascinating is then looking at this guy since. What happens to this guy, Scott Thorson? And he turns out to have lived the most extraordinary life. When the writer catches up with him, he's actually in prison for identity theft. He has led a life of kind of petty crime. He's led a life where he became the lover of a famous gangster. He's at all times been involved in unbelievably sort of picaresque stories of crime and punishment. I will say one good thing about him is now he no longer has the chin implants, which I think is a great redemption for him.
And there is an HBO movie about this story that has been made. And of course, this article is talking about the real guy and the real story behind it. Let's talk about political luck next year, Tina Brown. President Obama, of course, rose to the White House in almost record time, extremely quickly in recent years. But of course, once he took office, he had the suerte, the luck of having to try to fulfill his own campaign promises, including one that's been exceedingly difficult.
Yes, well, of course, the president is involved at the moment in such a turmoil of scandals going on all at once. And in fact, this particular story we're going to talk about has had no luck at all when it comes to that. You know, on the campaign trail, the president said he was going to close Guantanamo Bay. And actually, nothing's happened. And now he's decided that he really has got to now address it, largely because there has been this appalling hunger strike in Guantanamo recently, in which it has been said publicly that the reason that they have gone on strike is because they themselves, who have been 11 years, many of them there, 11 years without any kind of due process, they have not been tried, they have not been allowed any kind of access to justice, they are there, stuck in limbo. Dan Kleinman in Digital Newsweek this week has done a wonderful piece really recapping all the times that Obama has dropped the ball on Guantanamo and what is now going to happen.
And you talk about luck. I mean, we have people at Guantanamo Bay, and we've heard a number of stories, some of them awful people, some of them they allege that they didn't do very much wrong at all. And in any case, they are beyond the reach of luck. That's the design of the system there.
Well, they're absolutely right. So, I mean, one of the great questions of this whole story is how to cajole self-interested lawmakers to take a major political risk, really, on behalf of men who have little or no constituency, as Dan Kleinman asks. And Obama's answer seems to be that he's going to make his case finally to the public. But my guess is that it will absolutely fall on deaf ears, given how little leverage he's got in the wake of the IRS scandal and the AP scandal and Benghazi, a trio of nightmares in his inbox.
Tina Brown is the editor of The Daily Beast and Newsweek. Tina, suerte.
Thank you. The same to you.